Good morning, everyone. Today's date is Thursday, March 5th, 2020. It's about 7:45 a.m. on the U.S. East Coast as I'm starting recording. I'm Tom Kaczynski. Welcome to Coronavirus Central. This is episode 22 now, I think. Seems like it's been a lifetime, doesn't it? We've gone through a lot, but we continue to fight onward against the virus, the army of humanity, and the war against that. I know some of you think that that's a little funny, and I read some of the comments, but I say it for a reason, because we are fighting a very big threat, and that this show every day comes on. We try to put the best information out there, anticipate some of the problems you'll face, and give you context to understand. And I want to thank everyone out there who's been helping me understand the medical aspects of it further. A number of nurses and doctors have become part of our open source intelligence network. Hopefully, as my information becomes more useful, or I should say my understanding of the information becomes more useful based upon learning of these things, we'll put better information out there. And we're always trying to get better at this, which is what we have to do because we are in a fight for our lives, and that is no joke. Let's jump into the cases pretty quickly today. Just a real quick preview of what we're going to have here. We got two sort of science-like news reports I think are interesting, which potentially corroborate other things we've talked about. We're going to talk about a couple outbreak areas that I am keeping an eye on, a little bit on the mathematical modeling side, and a lot more on the response. So touch a lot of different places related to this. I still want to get to the economy and the supply chain stuff, but that's going to require real research, which will happen over the weekend. It may require me to have either a late or delayed Saturday show, so we'll see if that happens. Okay, into the stories. Let's start with COVID19info.live. That's where we've been doing our daily updates from since the very beginning. Very useful website. And today's update, 7:40 a.m., U.S. East Coast, 95,790 confirmed cases, 3,286 confirmed deaths. That's 3.4% for those of you doing the math out there. We'll just go through the numbers of those countries that are over 100 here. Mainland China, 80,411 confirmed, 3,013 deaths. South Korea, 6,088 confirmed, 35 deaths. Italy, 3,089 confirmed, 107 deaths. Iran, 2,922 confirmed, 92 deaths. And I've been getting some information from two different sources, I should tell you, that says that this is actually far worse in Iran. And a big part of the problem there is that they don't have a good testing protocol, something we need to worry about, that they're having to do everything like China did for a while using the CT scans, which is a very good way to do it. But their medical profession apparently is suffering some considerable casualties from what we're hearing on the ground through direct sources. And there's a lot of rumors around what's happening in Iran, but you look at the degree of suffering that's happening there, the high case fatality rate, the differences in reporting, a lot to suggest things are not going well there. Japan, 331 cases, 6 deaths. France is getting high quick, 285 cases, 4 deaths. Same with Germany, 262 cases, 0 deaths. And there's this terrible thing. I was reading this thing from the Venice Tourism Department saying that they want the government to stop reporting how many cases there because it's costing them tourism money and that the rest of Europe is cheating. And I think it's sort of interesting on two levels. Number one, that they're saying that the big concern, of course, is the economics of this, which, you know, is problematic. But the second thing is that we are looking at that countries are potentially finding ways to reduce the number of cases they're reporting. We've talked a lot about how the World Health Organization seems to be facilitating that for any number of reasons. So continuing, Spain is up to 222 deaths. U.S., 159 confirmed, 11 deaths, and most of those are in Washington. We got a couple in California now, and we'll talk about the California cluster today. Singapore, 112, that number is going up, but slowly they're doing a good job controlling there. Hong Kong has been stuck at 105 for a little bit, 2 deaths, and then Switzerland's at 93, UK's at 68, and there's a glut of countries in the 50s. Australia's at 54, which I might want to mention. And India's at 28, the world's most populous country jumping into the chart. Cases coming out of Italy, apparently, in their case tracing and going to India. We'll have to talk about that, and I have an article on that for today. So that gives you a feel for what's happening with the numbers around the world. The article we're going to start with today, this is from the South China Morning Post. This was published today, actually, at 9:23 a.m., although that's local time to Hong Kong, so that's probably about 12 hours ago, 11 hours ago. Coronavirus recovered patient dies as China reports 139 new patients. A 36-year-old man has died in Wuhan from respiratory failure days after being discharged from hospital. Latest data from the mainland shows most new infections continue to occur at epidemic's epicenter. A 36-year-old man has died of respiratory failure in Wuhan 5 days after being discharged from one of the makeshift hospitals built to contain the outbreak, according to Shanghai-based news portal The Paper. Li Liang had been admitted to the hospital, built to treat patients with mild and moderate symptoms, on February 12th, according to his wife, surnamed May. He was discharged 2 weeks later with instructions to stay in a quarantine hotel for 14 days. May said her husband was not feeling well 2 days after leaving the hospital, with a dry mouth and a gaseous stomach. On March 2nd, Li said he felt sick and was sent to a hospital where he was certified dead that afternoon. The death certificate issued by the Wuhan Health Commission said the direct cause was COVID-19 and listed respiratory blockage and failure as the symptoms which could have led to his death. And so, look real fast here. So the rest of this article goes on to talk about things happening in other areas. But I think that that's a really interesting data point that's out there. And it fits one of these things we're seeing over and over again, which is we're asking, what does it mean to be cured, right? I mean, is it that the tests are delivering false positives? That's possible. Is it that people are not getting fully recovered and that they're in remission? Well, I think that's a possibility too. Or are they getting reinfected? Well, we know there's two different strains out there, at least based upon the reporting, and that given the nature of these sorts of viruses and how they mutate, there will probably be more. So this idea that someone is cured, I think, is really difficult to deal with. And it has a lot of implications and ramifications as we look at how we want to quarantine these people. And I think we need to have a much better understanding of the post-operative phase of people who are healed from this and what's actually happening. Are they carriers? How long are they infectious for? Does it really go away? And one of the things we reported on earlier this week is we shared a article that was talking about or speculating that there was a neurological component to this. So today we have another piece that might be adding evidence to this potentially, how we want to balance it. I'll let the medical researchers decide. Okay, this is from the Global Times of China, and this is was published yesterday at 1:49 a.m., I should say, looks like. Chinese doctor discovers novel coronavirus in patient's cerebrospinal fluid. A Chinese doctor has warned that the novel coronavirus can attack a person's central nervous system as gene sequencing at Beijing Ditan Hospital has found coronavirus in the cerebrospinal fluid of a 56-year-old confirmed COVID-19 patient with encephalitis, which provides evidence that COVID-19 can invade patients' nervous systems, just like SARS and MERS. It is the first case that proves the novel coronavirus can damage the people's central nervous system, media reported on Wednesday. Lu Jingyuan, dean of the ICU department at the Beijing Ditan Hospital and attending doctor of the 56-year-old patient, warned that doctors should check cerebrospinal fluid if patients suddenly slip in and out of consciousness in order to lower the fatality rate of critical patients. The patient, and just to go back to review the previous article for those who didn't listen, what it speculated was that the previous article, which was basically saying that people were having issues where the COVID infection would come in through secondary sources like the conjunctive nerves, the olfactory nerves, in the face, basically, different areas, and that it would hinder the medulla from managing the response, and that that would cause various issues, like the one person in the article, the young lady, who had reported that she had to remember to breathe. And from that, we put a little bit of an exciting headline out there saying that people might have been forgetting to breathe. But now we have a little more evidence of what's happening, that there is something, an issue of consciousness, awareness, and potentially maintenance of the autonomic nervous system based on this Dr. Lu Jingyuan. So to continue the article, The patient recovered and was discharged from hospital on February 25th. He was hospitalized 1 month earlier for respiratory failure. Doctors conducted gene sequencing on his cerebrospinal fluid as he showed symptoms of neurological disorder like twitching on the face after days of treatment, while a CT scan and a biochemical test results could identify the causes. 1 week before the case was revealed, Chinese researchers issued a preliminary paper warning that COVID-19 could possibly affect the patient's nervous system, according to media reports. The paper is authored by a team led by Hu Bo, a doctor from Union Hospital under the Huazhong University of Science and Technology, and has not been peer-reviewed. It said 30% of the 214 patients the team studied showed symptoms in the nervous systems, and the rate is even higher in critical patients at 45.5%. Now, I haven't even seen that paper yet. We'll bring it to you when it comes out here. But I think that if those numbers are anywhere near accurate, that we need to look at a whole different set of symptoms in addition to and potentially in conjunction with the respiratory pneumonia and different items out there, and consider how this connects with the evidence we're seeing on the ground and in the field. You know, we've all seen those videos of people falling over, fainting. We've seen how many people had to go on respirators. We're starting to understand that COVID is not what we think it is. And do we know what it is? No, but this is indicative. And, you know, one of the things we are trying really hard to do here is get this information out so that people in the medical field, and I want to thank all the doctors and nurses who listen to the show especially. I want to thank you for your efforts in the field. Definitely, we all appreciate you. We want to support you. We want to see you protected. And hopefully, the stuff I'm putting out there will help direct your own research. I realize I'm a lay person. It's probably like listening to someone speak pigeon science, and I appreciate that. I'm learning as fast as I can, I assure you, and your guidance helps. And if there's anything that you come up with, feel free to let us know. Many people give us tips, coronaviruscentral@pm.me, or send me a link on the Twitter at coronaviruscast. We're always looking, and we're doing it in the Telegram chat as well, t.me/coronaviruscentral. Okay, so the authors warn that doctors should pay attention to nervous system expressions and conduct virus tests while seeing symptoms to avoid misdiagnosis or delayed diagnosis, which would also help prevent the spread of the virus. China issued the 7th treatment guide for COVID-19 on Tuesday that includes results of autopsies, which clarifies that the novel coronavirus could damage various organs, including brain tissue. And I had two different medical professionals make what I thought was a really smart suggestion to me. It isn't one that I should be making, but it's one that I think we should see be made, which is we need to be coming up with a treatment guide for COVID that is standard issue. Now, I suggest the CDC should be on top of this in offering a standard clinical treatment, not just for treating people who are unwell, but for assessing through different means, both for people who have had this and unfortunately for deceased who are suspected, for how we can look at this. And now we see that, you know, maybe there are people who are having neurological expression. I think a reasonable question we could test is, are some of the asymptomatic people who are having these effects maybe having nervous system damage as the primary means of entry, or which is being fought off, versus having the more pronounced respiratory effects? I don't know that that's the case. It seems like the sort of thing we could test for, and that we shouldn't assume that the people getting through this well are getting through unscathed. We just don't know. Okay. So we're going to go on to, those are our two news stories for today on the science of it. And we're going to go on to India here. We're going to some of the case stuff. This is from CNN News, 6:09 a.m., Joshua Berlinger, CNN. India identifies 29 coronavirus cases as global infections top 95,000. Hong Kong. A spike in novel coronavirus in India has prompted concerns that the world's second most populous country could face its own outbreak of the deadly virus, which to date has infected more than 95,000 people and killed at least 3,283 worldwide. 29 cases have been confirmed inside the country, including 3 who have recovered. Many of the cases are linked to a group of travelers from Italy, the hardest-hit country in Europe, Health Minister Harsh Vardhan said. Authorities in the country have advised caution but have not raised the alarm. Vardhan told lawmakers in Parliament Tuesday that public health authorities are focused on India's core capacities for disease preparedness and response. The government has begun screening all passengers arriving in the country for coronavirus. The scale and extent of our interventions have increased in alignment with the evolving situation of COVID-19 across the world, and India in particular, he said, referring to the disease by its formal name. With the increasing global spread of the disease, we are confronted with new challenges. The contact tracing of positive cases requires the tracing of hundreds of contacts in multiple locations and monitoring their health. Vardhan also said the government was preparing a containment plan for the city of Agra, home to the Taj Mahal, where a cluster of cases has been identified. Prime Minister Narendra Modi said there is no need to panic earlier this week on Twitter and has advised the public that the government is working together to stop the virus from spreading further. Modi said Wednesday he would not attend next week's Holi celebrations, or is that Holi? I'm not sure. The Hindu festival that marks the start of spring, in which revelers throwing bright-colored powdered paint because of advice from experts to avoid mass gathering. Those festivities at the presidential palace were also canceled. Authorities around the globe are taking similar steps now that the virus has spread to more than 80 countries and territories across every continent except Antarctica. Okay, I'm just reading through. So this is just, the article goes on to talk about economic impacts and a whole bunch of other things because this is a bunch of updates. But I just wanted to share that bit about India. And India is really important in this equation just because it's the world's largest population. You know, we're talking about, was it like 1.5 billion people? Something like that. So definitely something to be concerning. And what we see is that things are spreading different ways and that the refusal to shut down borders between countries is causing a lot of problems. At this point, not just Italy, but I think we have to assume reasonably Germany, Spain, and France are going to be heavily affected with community endemic spread. And I would suspect the UK is also on that list and other smaller countries in Europe, especially in Western and Central Europe. I don't have as much transparency on Eastern Europe, but it would be surprising if it didn't happen there, considering how labor actually operates in Europe. And now we are seeing this in India, which isn't to say it wasn't there, but India has a lot of people, issues with their healthcare system, as would be expected but for a country that size. Something to keep an eye on as COVID continues its spread worldwide. Okay. So this is from the USA Today, written by John Bacon. Published, it looks like at 7:21 a.m. Eastern Time. Coronavirus live updates. California and L.A. declare emergencies as U.S. death toll hits 11. As the U.S. death toll reached 11, California Governor Gavin Newsom and Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti declared states of emergency as Los Angeles County announced 6 additional cases of the deadly coronavirus that has health officials around the world scrambling for answers. More than 150 cases had been confirmed across the nation. Los Angeles had confirmed just one before Wednesday's announcement. A death reported Wednesday by California's Placer County near Sacramento represents the first fatality outside of the state of Washington. County officials referred to the victim as an elderly adult with underlying health conditions. They said the patient was in isolation at a local hospital and probably exposed to the virus on a trip aboard a Princess's cruise ship that traveled from San Francisco to Mexico in February. The state of California is deploying every level of government to help identify cases and slow the spread of this coronavirus, Newsom said. This emergency proclamation will help the state further prepare our communities and our health care system in the event it spreads more broadly. And just add one other piece to this, a related story connected to this on the same page. Cruise ship blocked from docking in San Francisco. And for the people out there who I know are not listeners to this podcast, but out there at large that I hear about all the time, just thinking how they're going to get back to vacations and cruises, hopefully this will serve as an inducement to be a little more cautious in their actions. Thousands of people on board Princess Cruises' Grand Princess may have been exposed to coronavirus after sailing with 62 passengers who community officials said had previously been on a voyage with a man who eventually died from the virus. A 71-year-old man from California died from coronavirus after sailing on the Grand Princess on a previous cruise from San Francisco. The current cruise was scheduled to arrive Wednesday evening back in San Francisco, but is being held off the coast until passengers can be tested, Governor Gavin Newsom said. We have a number of passengers and cruise members that have developed symptoms on this cruise ship. So we might have our own version of the Diamond Princess here now off the coast of the San Francisco Bay, not to mention the other one we talked about, the Maraviglia, that is down off the coast of Cozumel in Mexico. So the bottom line, ladies and gentlemen, is don't go on a cruise ship. If you're on a boat that isn't just your boat, you're probably not in good shape, all right? We got the first case out of South Africa. A number of our listeners are from there. I've been asked to keep an eye on this. So just a quick update 10 minutes ago. This is just breaking news here from today. Breaking novel coronavirus, South Africa's first positive case of COVID-19 confirmed. Health Minister Zweli Mkhize has confirmed that South Africa's first suspected case of COVID-19 is tested positive. The health minister released a statement on Thursday confirming the National Institute for Communicable Diseases confirmed a positive test. The patient is a 38-year-old male who traveled to Italy with his wife. They were part of a group of 10 people, and they arrived back in South Africa on March 1st, Mkhize said in a statement. The patient consulted a general practitioner on March 3rd with symptoms of fever, headache, malaise, sore throat, and a cough. The practice nurse took swabs and delivered it to the laboratory, and the patient has been self-isolating since March 3rd. Couple also had two children. Emergency operating center has identified the contacts by interviewing the patient and doctor, and the tracer team has been deployed to Natal with epidemiologists and clinicians from the NICD. The health minister said the doctor has been self-isolated as well. This media briefing is to ensure the public is immediately kept abreast. And they said more information would follow. So that's going to be another large population. It's going to probably have a lot of problems maintaining if this spreads. But it's also interesting to see that we are seeing coronavirus now transfer to different places. And one of the theories that has been floating out there is the question of if this behaves like other coronaviruses, where it will spread more easily in the cold in the same way that we think the cold is a flu season, and the flu is more, less susceptible to, cold weather than hot conditions. It'll die more easily in hot conditions. Will COVID behave that same way? Now we're getting some cases that are in different geographic zones, but different climate zones, especially in the southern hemisphere. That might give us some evidence to work on this particular question. I also wanted to include one other point here, which I think might be helpful to you, which is, we talked a little bit yesterday in our deep dive into Washington about how it was a researcher with the Seattle flu study that actually went ahead and went slightly beyond their mandate that was so instrumental in helping Washington identify the cluster that's up there. And while some of the businesses in Seattle probably aren't too happy to be seen as the epicenter, the reality is more likely that Seattle is just ahead of the game in terms of understanding what's happening on the ground, as opposed to other places where it is likely there is just as widespread of coronavirus moving about, but that we don't know about it. And I mention this only for one reason. Even when I go on Twitter every day, there are people who come to me and say, oh, this isn't as bad as the flu. This isn't as bad as the flu. When the people who study the flu, like the Seattle flu study, are redevoting their efforts and resources to acting upon coronavirus and COVID-19, that is the evidence we should present to them to say, if the people who study the flu think this is more important than studying the flu for this moment, does that not suggest to you that maybe you too need to take COVID more seriously? Just a thought. Maybe it will be helpful. There's a little tweet about that on my Twitter. You can take a look at it. But I want to say also, if you haven't looked at the work that they're doing, it's absolutely amazing how well they've been working, and they've really been working very hard to understand the connection between where these different virus strands are coming from, and that they have found, for instance, that the strands in Germany, okay, could go back to original infections, like one or two that go back as early as January. Chris Martinson was reporting on that on the Peak Prosperity podcast. So this has been around longer than we think, and while Italy seems to be doing a very good job of spreading what might be a more virulent, more expressive version of this that may or may not be related to other places, maybe related to Iran. We don't know which strains are where, if this is the L strain, if this is the S strain, if this is another strain. I know there's a lot of demand for medical researchers to start figuring it out, and I hope that resources are being directed that attention. But what we do certainly know is that, you know, looking into where this could be will have us going in different places, because now we are having people posthumously found, that is to say, after they've been dead from autopsy, we are finding them have been carriers of this. Or not carriers, they were victims of it. Okay, so the next thing I want to go to here is a little bit of modeling of how we want to look at this. Because I think that people ask me very often how to understand what is actually happening here, right? And what the actual numbers are. And, you know, obviously the formula has a lot of constantly moving variables, right? And we have to always check our assumptions. But I'm going to give you a very, very easy formula that might help offer at least an estimation that is not crazy wrong for how to understand this. And it's, I put this on the Twitter feed, and I'll share it with you in the notes for the thing. But this is my personal COVID-19 formula, okay? For every person you find who is symptomatic, you can presume at least 50 cases in that cluster. And clusters will usually, but not always, be geographic. For every death, you can presume at least 200 cases in that cluster. And this model assumes a median 7 days to symptoms, 14 days to death, and cases will double weekly. And the reason it works is very simple, that we are assuming here a very simple assumption that for every one person who appears sick, four people aren't, but they are spreaders, because that fits the evidence. We also assume in the same deal that we are having for every person that dies, we're assuming the same split. We're assuming that ends up happening is that that represents at least one person, even if there was a 100% chance of death, because I could make that number a lot higher if I did this differently. But we're assuming that one of those people who ends up dying, which is at a median rate of about 14 to 17 days, they have had enough time for four generations of the virus to spread. That is to say, go from person to person to person to person. Same with people being symptomatic, except they haven't had as much time. So it's the number of cases times person to person. And I went ahead and checked my formula against some basic math here to see if it made sense to give you a different way of thinking about it. Say you accept the case fatality rate at present at 3.5%, supported by the World Health Organization, okay? So 1 divided by 0.035 is 28, which means there's a 1 in 28 chance that someone will die from it. So if you start from that presumption that there's one person who dies for 28 who has it, and do the same mathematical modeling, you end up with approximately 56 cases, in theory, that are out there. That it would be if this was symptomatic, or if you do it over the death rate, 224. So the reason I'm sharing all that with you is that people have asked how you look at it. So if you're willing to trust my math a little bit, and I present it much more clearly when you can read it, just think, when you see someone who has this, who has a symptom, there's probably up to 50 people out there, unless the case tracing is excellent. Same way, if someone dies, 200 people has it. Bad news in terms of the spread, good news in terms of the fatality rate. The case fatality rate will, in terms of just the number of people getting sick who die without medical intervention, will probably continue to drop over time. The caveat, and it's a big one, is that those who need severe care need to have access to it of high quality and high capacity. That's going to be the bottleneck. We all know we're going there, and we're going to have a story about that, actually. You know what? We're going to have a story right now. I'll move the order of the cases around. So this is from The Guardian, Tim Cook. I'm an ICU doctor. The NHS isn't ready for the coronavirus crisis. And this was from Tuesday, March 3rd, 6:12 Eastern Time. As the virus spreads, hospitals need to step up plans to care for the very sick, recruit more staff, and cancel routine surgery. And this is from a doctor in the UK for their health service. Coronavirus and the disease it causes, COVID-19, have dominated the headlines. Yet, the range of expectations and predictions of its impacts have been so wide as to make clear understanding almost impossible. This is perhaps inevitable when we grapple with a fast-moving and previously unknown illness. What is clear is that as knowledge grows, it has become evident that this has the potential to be one of the most fatal epidemics to have hit the world for a century, and it is rapidly increasing in prevalence in the UK. I work as a doctor in an intensive care unit, ICU. It is a specialty which most of the public have little understanding of unless they have required our services. What is in no doubt is that the ICU sits at the center of all that is necessary for keeping alive what may be a very large number of patients who will develop severe COVID-19. ICU treats patients whose lives are at risk or whose lungs have organs have failed. Severe COVID leads mostly to lung failure, but also causes cardiovascular and kidney failure. And now we have maybe neurological to add to that, you know, depending on, you know, what comes out as further research from China, just my interjection. All of these are rapidly fatal without intense and prompt treatments only available in ICU. In simple terms, treatments include a ventilator taking over the patient's breathing while the patient is anesthetized, placed in an induced coma, a dialysis machine cleaning the blood and drugs or machines supporting the heart and blood pressure. The reality of care is, of course, considerably more complex and intensive. So let's look at some statistics. It is likely that more than 30% of the whole UK population will get COVID-19. It may be as high as 60% in some estimates. And I would even argue it could be higher than that, but especially if we don't start quarantining soon. But let's hope it stays down and this doesn't end up being endemic, recurring, and ongoing. Okay, so most will have no or mild illness, but maybe 1 in 7 will need hospital admission. Of patients in hospital, 1 in 5 may need ICU care. So that's kind of interesting. They're saying 1 in 7 there. They're estimating, I guess, that they are thinking it's going to be around 14 to 15%. Historically, we've seen higher numbers than that. I'm curious why they think that would be lower. Of patients in hospital, up to 1 in 5 may need ICU care. That would be an unprecedented number of people admitted to the ICU. As many as 1 in 50 patients known to have COVID-19 may die from it. So that projects a case fatality rate of 2%. Right now, the global projected rate is 3.4%, but we'll see, that's highly variable. ICU is a precious and scarce resource in terms of beds, staffs, and equipment. This is especially so in the UK. In 2012, the UK had about 4,100 critical care beds, including ICU beds and high dependency beds, which are a step down from full ICU care. Compared with other European countries, the UK ranked 23rd and 31 in terms of ICU beds per head of In terms of ICU beds per head of population and 29th of 31 for all hospital beds. Sorry, there was a little ad that popped up in the damn article. Germany has approximately 4 times as many ICU beds per capita as the UK, and the USA perhaps tenfold as many. And we looked at the USA numbers, and this podcast reported to you late last week that we need 400 times the capacity that we have. So if the same numbers hold towards England, they need 4,000 times, or I should say Great Britain. All respect to the Northern Irish, right? Most UK ICUs therefore run at or above 90% occupancy and often can only admit new patients only by discharging others, even when the workload is normal. COVID will increase pressures not only because of the weight of numbers, but because intermediate treatments for pneumonia and lung failure are aerosol generating, so they cannot be used, and early recourse to ICU is required. This is going to be a big problem, too, for hospitals, controlling the air supply of this. And it's interesting here, as much as you see the CDC saying that this isn't aerosol-generated, you see here that a doctor in the UK isn't saying the opposite. That fits the evidence we've seen from China, from Wuhan, from the Diamond Princess, and elsewhere. One more example of the way in which we are seeing inadequate treatment protocols and understanding of the disease lead to putting healthcare providers and patients alike at risk. This is something that's understood, and there needs to be some sort of better centralized entity for putting out information. In theory, that's what the World Health Organization is supposed to be doing. In practice, it's the politicians trying to dominate the doctors instead of the other way around, and it's really unfortunate, and I think we need something else. Like what, frankly, our open source network is trying to help facilitate as an intelligence asset. Okay, so increased ICU demands equate to each ICU bed need for approximately 100 more patients than on average in the epidemic period, at least 10 times the normal throughput, and equivalent to needing to add at least another 10 ICUs in the hospital during the epidemic. Of course, this demand will be in addition to, rather than instead of, normal workload of illnesses that will usually require ICU admission that will not go away during the epidemic. In Wuhan, ICU capacity was increased by over 1,000 beds in 2 weeks by building a new hospital, but this is not possible in the UK. Okay, so let me just insert a little thing we know from another article to put it into your mind while we're talking about this. We've reported that there are the vast majority of many active pharmaceutical products, antibiotics that would be used against secondary infection, items like heparin that are used in the monitoring of patients while they're in, there are already in short supply here in the United States. The same stands to be true for Europe and the UK. A lot of the production for these things coming from China worldwide, and the China supply chain is broken down. Supplies are already starting to go down. They're not quite dwindling, but we've had updates and reports from the FDA about a growing number of problems, and I've had a number of hospital administrators and pharmacists tell me that this is real and it is accelerating, and we now have on the horizon, 3 to 6 weeks from now, perhaps sooner, that we're going to have a major run on the hospitals where they're going to not only need to surge the capacity of the people in the hospital, but also the supplies in order to be able to treat them properly. So identifying what key supplies the ICU needs to survive in a accelerated context with many more people should be a priority of every government worldwide. And at the same time we're doing this, as I think Chris Martinson did a very good job of last night, India has now started placing restrictions on the exportation of their own pharmaceutical supply in anticipation of their own needs at home. So this is part of a larger breakdown, right? The doctors are looking at this from the medical perspective, which is very valid, and that's one of the points we make a point of emphasis. We want to help them as our frontline soldiers. But we, from behind, as the citizens who are a support network for them, have to look at this logistically. Just like in an army, they say you need like 20, or I think it's like you need 12 support soldiers for every one frontline soldier. We have to figure out how we are going to go ahead and get the resources we need to them, and our governments need to be directing us to identify critical supplies, surge manufacturing capacity right now. In fact, hopefully they were doing it before now. The time to start was literally 4 weeks ago, so that they can go ahead, and when the ICU demand comes, there's no good sending people to an ICU where all you can do is put a washcloth on someone's head. And if that happens, what will happen is doctors will give up, nurses will give up, they won't show, there'll be absenteeism, and this is how you have the collapse of the medical system. So the emphasis here I want to make is that we need to get in front of this. We now have a growing set of data points that make very clear from medical professionals, from the case data in Wuhan, that we have this first battle we have to win, which is the battle of the ICU. How do we do that? There's two ways, right? We channel the number of people going in. That's self-quarantine measures and perhaps enforce quarantine measures. I mean, I think we can have that conversation about people who are at high risk, that we try to prevent them being out there so that this overrun doesn't happen. The other sense is curative, that we need to get them the ammunition they need. That's the medical supplies the ICU needs for the most common COVID symptoms. Now, let's go back to the article. So Mr. Cook actually will, I don't think it's Doc, or it has to be Dr. Cook. He's out there. So let's look, just 1 second here. Managing a patient, no, that's not it. Increased ICU demands equate to each ICU bed being needed for approximately 100 more patients on average during the epidemic period, at least 10 times the normal. I read that already. Sorry, I just not feeling great today. Don't worry, I don't have it. It's just one of those things here. All right. Of course, this demand will be in addition to rather than instead of the normal workload. In Wuhan, ICU capacity was increased by over 1,000 beds in 2 weeks by building a new hospital, but this is not possible in the UK. Well, it needs to be possible in the UK, and it needs to be possible in the USA, and it needs to be possible everywhere. We need to figure out a way to solve these problems, not, you know, admit we can't do it. But he tells us managing an ICU patient with COVID is more complex than normal ICU care. Patients must be individually isolated. All staff must wear personal protective equipment, which consists of, as a minimum, a tight-fitting face mask, an extra gown, gloves, goggles, and visor. PPE must be put on and taken off before and after patient contact and checked by a buddy colleague. Despite this scrupulous process in China, 2 in every 5 early infections were acquired in the hospital, and 2/3 of these were healthcare workers, a significant number of whom then died. These demands slowed down care, increased the number of staff needed, and exposed staff and perhaps their families to significant risk. And, you know, that's going to have consequences. Patients in ICU have constant one-to-one nursing. Medical interventions are frequent, invasive, and performed at extremely close proximity. Contact with bodily fluids is inevitable and common, but it is not only nurses and doctors who are at risk. Hospital cleaners will be required to be on hand at all times, and rigorous cleaning is required between patients and after many procedures. Physiotherapists, dieticians, lab techs, and other medical specialists involved in the care are also at risk. Keeping staff safe has implications beyond their welfare. Skilled staff are a limited resource, and if sickness rates are even moderate there, there will be major gaps in service. And that's a big problem because they don't have enough to begin with. The challenge from COVID to ICU services in the UK is enormous and pressing. Throughout the UK, ICUs are preparing exceptional plans and training all staff to manage these patients with skill and safety for the patients themselves. You know, maybe they need to draft some other people, like I said, as being... they used to call them candy stripers. These ideas you'd have stand-in nurses who maybe can't do anything, but they can, you know, monitor things. And I hate to say it, I don't love this solution, but maybe we need to expand the ability for automated capacities to help do some of this management, you know, that would be helpful within these ICUs if we can build, you know, the ventilators and the other goods and get those out. I don't know how difficult the construction is of that, but it's actually a question I want to ask, and I will try... just writing a note right now, actually. And I took a little note there. We're going to look and see if we can figure out how hard it is to get ventilators built and what kind of bottlenecks exist there. Hopefully, government people are doing that. If you have resources, man, this show is here to spawn ideas, so run with it. Because actually, what happens a lot, just, I mean, you guys might find this funny, well, not funny, but interesting as an aside, I actually pause the show quite a bit, and I take down notes, because as I'm talking to you and thinking aloud, basically, which is what this show does, what I'm doing is I'm also sharing information so that I know where to look in the future, and just asking key questions, which is not like, how do we protect ourselves, but it's different. I say, what is the problem? How can we solve it? How can we mitigate it? And we just need to constantly ask that. And whatever our area is, each person can do this, even in your own lives. You can mitigate the risk that you represent to the system, help others not be there, and that's how this whole process works pretty well. Okay, so where are we here? Hospitals are acting to expand ICU care outside of their existing footprint and double or even triple ICU capacity, most likely by taking over operating theaters. This expansion will involve engaging anesthetists, we call them anesthesiologists here in the U.S., and others to provide ICU medical care and nurses from elsewhere in the hospital to work as ICU staff. To facilitate this, much or all routine surgery will need to stop. That is starting to happen, actually. We've heard about that from the Veterans Administration, actually, through a couple sources. Many patients with COVID will also be hospitalized outside of ICU, and care for those patients and those in ICU will have major consequences for caring for other patients who do not have COVID. One of the things we haven't thought about a lot, and I don't know exactly how you would assess this, but it's an important question, is what will the surge of ICU cases and COVID cases mean for those people who are in hospitals already and who don't have that but who need support? These are presumably a lot of people who have, how should I say, a more likely propensity to have underlying health conditions or to be weakened in some meaningful way, and they are now at the epicenter of where people coming with a highly infectious, highly dangerous disease is going to be coming in. How that's managed, how these people are brought in and triaged needs to be a part of the medical procedure discussion that we have started talking about. And I'm going to try to put something together. I'm going to ask, and for doctors and nurses out there who are listening, I know there's a number of you, some of them in the Telegram group, somewhat. Tell me ideas you have of things that we could do. And keep in mind, I know that supplies are short. So what are some really smart, easy, or creative ideas that we have? Let's put them out there. And then, you know, what happens, and I've heard this from several people, is ideas we talk about on Coronavirus Central end up working their way to conversations in boardrooms. They get, you know, as I say, sanitized of my influence, right? But that's not really what's important. What happens is the ideas get out there, and these ideas offer the opportunity of greater safety, and, you know, they save lives. And that's what the show's all about, man. We're out here saving lives and hopefully making this a little less bad. All right. Whether these extreme precautions will be needed is unknown. If they are, whether even these measures will be sufficient is also unknown. Not so optimistic about it, but we got to try. We will find out over the next few weeks and months. In meantime, preparations need to be accelerated, coordinated, and we need to be honest and transparent about the potential impact of a Wuhan-type epidemic here in the UK, which will no doubt pose a major challenge for everyone working in the National Health Service. And Dr. Cook serves in an ICU NHS unit, we are informed. So, there's going to be a lot of problems. We know that. That's not surprising. Hopefully the NHS is doing that. Instead, here's what the NHS is actually doing. This is from TheGuardian.com. Move to weekly UK coronavirus updates criticized by experts. Decisions raises fears public won't be able to make informed choices to control outbreak. This was published yesterday at 4:20 p.m. by Matthew Weaver and Haroon Sadiq. The government has been accused of withholding information, this is in the UK, about the spread of coronavirus after a 70% increase in confirmed cases prompted health officials to stop providing daily updates on the location of new infections, as Downing Street confirmed that discussions are taking place on contingency plans to close the Houses of Parliament if the outbreak becomes widespread. 36 new UK cases were announced on Wednesday. So, three of the cases were believed to have been contracted within the UK, confirming fears that community transmission is already occurring and that attempts to contain the virus have at least partly failed. There are so many stories of people who think they might have had this going around, trying to get help, not getting it, or people who had it behaving terribly recklessly, like the guy in New Hampshire who left the hospital to go to a business meeting. This is community spread at this point. I think we have to assume that. Health officials faced a backlash over a decision not to release information about where new cases are until a weekly roundup announced each Friday. They said the move was a response to the sheer number of new cases, but a former director of the Public Health England said the move should be reconsidered to allow the public to make informed choices. They're also saying in this article, I'm just going real fast to this, that Italy's closing all schools and universities. I think we need to think about doing that. I've been sort of hesitant. I don't want to overreact things. But honestly, kids are the super spreaders in this case. They're bringing it to the parents. They come home, and that's how it gets to the old people. We've seen enough evidence of this. Schooling has to go from home. At the end of this week, this weekend, if you're a school administrator, you want to look real smart, you know, for the future, shut it down, man. Just shut it down, figure out, make a plan, work with staff and faculty, provide at-home learning. There's a lot of great resources. I'm sure there are people out there. If people know some of them, share it with our group. I'll put it out on Coronavirus Cast and try to spread it up the line. But we need to do this. This is just... And then we go through here, I'll give you another example of a dissenting opinion. Dr. Jennifer Cole, biological anthropologist at Royal Holloway, University of London, who carried out the research into information exchange during the Ebola crisis, said the move risked the spread of fake news. She said, quote, "I think it's an incredibly ill-advised decision. If it's not released officially, it creates an information vacuum, which will be filled by unreliable sources. Containment is going to be down to public behavior and public response. To not take into account what the public want leaves the government and NHS to accusations about not being transparent." And they identify other countries have been more open about the spread of the virus, including Singapore identifies the street where cases are confirmed. Singapore tells you everything about the person but their name. And in South Korea, phone alerts signify when users come within 100 meters of a confirmed case based on government data. That's how people protect themselves. Here, the government is protecting itself. There, the governments are protecting their citizens. And I hate to make it sound that way, but honestly, it's just true. So what they're saying is they're trying to figure out what to do in the UK. And what they're doing is they're having meetings. They're not acting. And they need to act better because it's a problem. And it's not just the UK. This seems to be a problem throughout the whole Western world, to be honest with you. Let's see what else we got here in terms of cases. So, you know, we talk about things being handled well and things being handled poorly. I'll give another case example. This is from the Spanish news source El Mundo. And I'm having a hard time getting it to load now, but I remember the story pretty well, and I'll put it up for you. What they were saying was the government refused to test a young girl who was 4 years old, who was sick, who met every bit of criteria for having coronavirus, except for the fact that she was a young woman. And when we looked at it, they decided essentially that they were unwilling to test, and they found out a couple days later that she was, in fact, sick. because the parents managed to find someone who would test them. And I mention this case only to show that we can't have presumptions about what COVID is. We need to have a much better understanding of what it is rather than that. But, you know, we don't see governments doing that. We see things like this. And this was shared to me with one of our listeners from the Florida Sun Sentinel. I think it's Florida anyways. Let me see. The South Florida Sun Sentinel. Apologize. It's small and still pretty early. My eyes aren't awake yet. This is by Cindy Krishner Goodman or Krisher Goodman. Apologies. Federal rules changed to allow more testing for coronavirus. A great decision. Florida isn't going to follow them. Florida will not follow new national guidelines that allow doctors to order tests for anyone they suspect of having new coronavirus, according to healthcare providers briefed on the state's plan. And Florida's been really terrible while putting information out there. And, you know, look, I just said this is not a political judgment. This is a competency judgment. DeSantis is failing miserably down there. Governor DeSantis is doing a very poor job of this, poor job of transparency, and poor job of letting people act for their own health security. Now, could it be because Florida has a population that has a disproportionately high number of senior citizens and people with existing conditions? Possibly. Could it also be that Florida's economy is heavily dependent on tourism? So we see, as we've heard from places like Las Vegas or early in the case, where Macau, which is basically a casino town at this point in China, kept their borders open, that they did so because of economic reasons? Possibly. But this is the problem that's ongoing. What's happening now? People in Florida are being put at health risk. The federal changes allow doctors to test more people faster to contain the spread of the highly contagious virus. Instead, Florida health providers have been advised to order tests only for people who fit a narrow criteria, a history of travel to high-risk area, or close contact with a confirmed coronavirus patient within 14 days of showing symptoms. So you have to prove you were with someone who had this, but you can't get tested unless you had it. You can see the whole way the loop works, and it's designed to prevent this. Why? Florida officials are concerned the state's three labs in Miami, Jacksonville, and Tampa would be overwhelmed by the number of tests, slowing the entire process. Officials with the Florida Department of Health did not respond to a request for comment about not testing under the expanded guidelines. We will work with the CDC if we reach an overwhelming volume of tests. So you have two agencies that have bad track records working together. I feel bad for our Floridian friends, said Alberto Moscoso, communications director with the Florida Department of Health. With four confirmed cases of COVID amongst Floridians, concerned doctors want more sites to be more available so they can test more people. I mean, when the doctors are asking for help, right, it's not even just the people, and the state health board is stonewalling them, it's a big problem. Daniel Perez, a plantation infectious disease doctor, wants to follow the national guidelines. I think it's appropriate to test anyone we think has coronavirus, Perez says. As we start to see more cases, if there is concern with a patient, we need to know whether someone is negative or positive for containment purposes. We need to know what we're dealing with. And this is the irony of it. Poor response, whether through intent or lack of planning, is going to create a situation where you can't ask someone to quarantine themselves or contain other than as a voluntary measure, absent some diagnostic model, right? And so Florida now is going to get it much worse because of the fact that their government doesn't have an answer for this. And you know, this is, and you could say, well, they didn't know it was coming. That's a load of crap. We've been talking about this for 3 weeks. I always tell the joke, if a guy on the internet and a cabin in Maine can figure this out, why can't you? I don't even have a budget for this. Although hopefully that will change and we'll talk about that later. But I wanted to go through here. It's just saying I'm skipping through this here. U.S. senators this week pushed Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Stephen Hahn about his promise in a Monday news conference to have 1 million tests ready by the end of this week. This is good information. The companies that we're working with this on, they have the capacity to develop enough tests to send out by the end of the week, and this is a dynamic process. Every day we're hearing from additional manufacturers that they can do this, Hahn said, predicting that 2,500 kits, each with 500 tests, will be ready by the end of the week. And we'll just do some real quick math here. If they each have 500 tests in there, that would be, times 5 is 12, 5. So 125,000, that's a good number. That's getting out there quick. This should give us the capacity in the hands of laboratories once they validate to perform up to 1 million tests. One thing America's got going for it, that we really actually have a great understanding of manufacturing capacity and that we can upsurge what we need very quickly. This is why good policy is so important. We can actually mitigate a lot of big problems, not all of them, but a lot of them to help if we go ahead and we focus those efforts. And I'm glad to see that there are multiple manufacturers getting on board. I would submit to you in the short term as we keep an eye on what's happening in Congress. I haven't talked about my perspective on the policy of what's being pushed for the coronavirus, but I know that lawmakers have a tendency to look for easy solutions rather than intermediate steps. Let's make sure that while money is certainly going to go to a vaccine and toward a vaccine, and I think that that's fine, although I have questions about how effective that will ultimately prove given that we have a mutating virus and that we've had problems with creating vaccines for coronaviruses in the past, that we need to make sure we're not just throwing all of our money at the cure, at the end goal, but at all the steps to prevent the people who suffer in between. That's not as exciting. It probably won't be as well understood. People aren't going to be going out there anticipating all those steps. Let's hope that we, as people, can tell our lawmakers what need to happen and have doctors kind of take the front and say what they need and commission them to become part of this and say, we need this, 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 and that, and then the people intelligently build the infrastructure to make sure that happens. Okay, hospitals in Florida want to be able to test faster and more frequently, Jamie Caldwell, president of the South Florida Hospital and Healthcare Association. The CDC changing criteria is contingent on the test being more locally available. A lot of providers are concerned and want to do everything they can to be prepared for the worst-case scenario. They talk about Dr. Stephen E. Resnick wanting to be able to test patients with respiratory illness regardless of Florida restrictions because he has a large elderly clientele. Said the health providers feel burdened right now with how to respond to suspected coronavirus cases. In fact, he may have to tell patients not to come into his office. If they can't get tested and we don't have protective gear when someone calls and wants to come to my office, we're going to have to make a tough call. This is a bad situation all around. Okay, let's see here. In Sarasota, where one of the Florida cases has been confirmed, doctors are pushing hard for expanded testing. Nearly a dozen patients at Sarasota Memorial Hospital are waiting for coronavirus test results, and doctors at the facility are saying they want to test patients themselves instead of sending samples to the Department of Health's Tampa lab, right? And in response, Congressman Vern Buchanan of Sarasota is pushing for a federal bill that will better fund federal test kits. I think that's good. I'm glad to hear that. As we see, like Dr. Cook's article that I read from The Guardian, we need much more protective gear. We need better protocols. We need hospitals to be getting those protocols. Briefings. The CDC should be doing a daily briefing at minimum for healthcare providers. Even if you want to be sneaky and not tell the public what's happening, tell the hospital administrators, for God's sakes, and don't just say, don't panic, don't worry. Now is a time for proactive action that's intelligent. You know, if someone's coming, all right, use the military metaphor again. If someone's attacking your base, the panicking thing is not to go run out in your barracks naked. You put your gear on, you go out, you start lining yourself in direction against the threat. That's what we need to do. We need to line up our doctors, right? So I want to share what else we got. I got one really good piece of news that might be helpful for this I want to share with you. This is from Channel News Asia. That's the main affiliate out of Singapore. New COV test kits used to screen swab samples collected at Singapore checkpoints. This is from Matthew Mohan, and this was published at 7:52 p.m. Today, which is probably just a few hours ago, so it's pretty new. Singapore, newly developed COVID test kits will be used to swab samples collected at Singapore's checkpoints from Thursday, March 5th, promising results within 3 hours. Wouldn't that be great? A collaboration between the Home Team Science and Technology Agency and Veritas Laboratories, the HTX COVID test kit has an accuracy of more than 99% and is able to test for a result in 3 hours, said the HTX in an information sheet. The test kit has provisional authorization from the Health Sciences Authority in Singapore and can be used directly by labs or hospitals to test patients for clinical diagnosis. This is faster than test kits deployed at hospitals, which not only test for the presence of COVID-19, but the severity of it. Swab samples are couriered from Singapore's land, sea, and air checkpoints and transported to the HTX lab at the Pasir Panjang Scanning Station. The lab can handle up to 200 samples a day with a team of 20 scientists on rotation. Let's see if we can adapt this process to being able to be done internally to hospitals at big areas. you know, sharing this information. It's good steps. A three-step process occurs at the laboratory. Scientists first extract the sample's RNA. This RNA is then converted into DNA before a process known as polymerase chain reaction takes place. This helps amplify the signal of the virus within the sample so it's more detectable. In the case that the sample tests positive, HTX informs the Ministry of Health, and as of 6 p.m. on Thursday, one sample has been sent for testing thus far. So this is just starting today. The Ministry of Health announced the introduction of the COVID-19 swab tests at Singapore's checkpoints on Tuesday. These may apply to travelers entering Singapore who have fever or other symptoms of respiratory illness. They include those who do not meet the clinical suspect case definition, said the ministry. Currently, at checkpoints, healthcare assistants conduct temperature screening for arriving travelers. Those who display symptoms of a fever are escorted to health screening stations, where they will be further assessed by nurses. Swabbing is then carried out on a case-by-case basis. After the test, they may proceed to seek immigration clearance to enter Singapore, but are advised to minimize contact with others. They will then be contacted when the results are released, and those with positive results will be taken to hospital in a dedicated ambulance. This is a really exciting development. Positive testing, higher capacity, shows the severity of the caseload, and can be done in 3 hours. This is why Singapore is doing a great job. We keep giving a lot of attention to them. Let's learn from their examples, right? That's really good. So we have, what else am I going to bring up for you guys today? I wanted to mention this case because a lot of people put in my attention. Fort Lee man with first New Jersey coronavirus case being treated at a Hackensack Medical Center. A 32-year-old Fort Lee man is New Jersey's first resident to be diagnosed with coronavirus, joining a growing list of patients. 130 at last count nationwide to contract the virus that has killed nearly 3,200 worldwide. The patient, who arrived at the emergency department at Hackensack University Medical Center on Tuesday, exhibited symptoms that caused clinicians to suspect he had COVID-19, the illness caused by coronavirus infection, said Dr. Daniel M. Varga, the chief physician executive for Hackensack Meridian Health, which operates Hackensack Medical Center. The patient was, doing well and resting comfortably in an isolation room. And he's very fortunate to be. Those are very rare. That's something, ideally, you would want people in isolation rooms so you can control the environment. But that is not going to be likely possible for very many people, just given the quantity of people who are going to be getting this. The staff followed protocols to identify, isolate, and evaluate the patient, Varga said. Good to see that we see a private entity taking those sorts of actions, something we recommend for all healthcare providers and systems. If your system doesn't have a policy, demand one, and you can go ahead. And like I say, this is a terrible thing to share with you, but always feel free to threaten legal action if you want to get someone to happen. Hospitals are paranoid of lawyers, man. It's just the truth. As testing for the virus becomes more widespread, it is likely the number of cases will continue to grow. They're talking about a cluster in New York, 10 in Westchester County, 1,000 people quarantined. In New Jersey, the diagnosis by the state health department laboratory is considered, quote, presumptive positive until it is confirmed by the federal CDC in Atlanta. I've heard a lot of people talk about this presumptive positive line. That means that the state finds it, but they don't want to own it yet for whatever reason, procedural. Some are good, some are less good, but they want a second set of eyes or a second test on it for the CDC. But they are treating as if it is legitimate, and I think that that's fine. I mean, I have no problem with getting secondary confirmation. I would question only if that is a great protocol just because of the number of people who are relying on the CDC for primary testing. I hope that we see an evolving protocol with perhaps these new test kits or some other technology domestically developed that sees the decisions about testing localized, decentralized, and sped up. And I think every country should consider taking a look at that. It just talks about public health officials are taking action. I'm sure they are, and we'll go from there. So the other piece I wanted to bring up for you guys, you know, I went through all the comments on the iTunes thing, and I want to thank, firstly, the many people who left nice comments, and also those who left, you know, criticisms that were helpful. Look, I mean, people can attack my past and my personality. That's fine. I mean, I'm doing what I'm doing. I don't make it about that. I suggest you don't either. If you have time to complain about where I come from, you're not oriented on the right issue, and that's how do we defeat COVID? And that's what I want us to focus on. But I am trying to solve some things. We did change the bit rate. We got rid of all the complaints that people had that it was buffering so badly. That's good news. And people haven't complained anymore about that part of the sound quality. A lot of people asking me about my mic usage. Just so you know what I actually do, I'm actually on an iPhone recording this, speaking into AirPods. So I don't actually move during the podcast. I'm not really sure why. The mic is oriented with respect to my mouth at the exact same position. But one of the things that we're going to try to do, because I am trying to meet your needs, is I'm looking at getting a different microphone solution. And the reason I record this on the iPhone, as opposed to doing it on a computer, I have a fancy Yeti mic that I use for the broadcast I do on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, is just because it would be very hard for me to do all the audio editing. And I've had people say, well, you could take more time, and I could, but my goal is to get the information to you as fast as possible. I admit we have sort of a grainy, gritty tendency on this program because of that, but I get the information to you first at a time when it is most useful to you. And if you put it this way, if you had someone come running and saying, you know, that a giant storm was coming, or a tornado was coming, and they came in your house and got your carpet muddy, would you complain about what the messenger looked like, or would you go ahead and go in the basement and try to save your family? That's the approach that we take here. But we are going to try to do that, and I want to share something. We're going to have a Kickstarter up here within the next week. I'll tell you the exact date on Friday, but I'm hoping you guys will support us. There's three levels. It's going to be $5, $20, $60, which represent contributions for 4 months at either just a $5, you know, just saying, hey, you're supporting us. $20 is $5 a month. I'm committing to doing this for 4 more months. We'll do it at least 5 times a week. There are times I'll have to take that 6th day off just because there's a lot of research involved. And that if you put it at the $60, I mean, if the information is worth $15 a month, you'd let us know. What we want to do is we want to get more information in foreign languages into English. That's been the key to understanding. So that would mean, in this case, translations potentially from Italian, translations from Chinese, from Japanese, from Singapore, although a lot of their stuff's in English, as well as getting information out there. Very sad cases in Iran. We want to get information through there and get transcriptions out. We are a global network. We want to bring everyone on board. That's part of the solution. So if you can give up a cup of coffee, I know that we get 20,000 listeners. Each of you guys kick up $5, and I'm only trying to raise $8,000 to basically sustain the podcast, $12,000 in total to add those services, which is a very small number. Basically, if everyone kicked in $5, or even if 10% of you kicked in $5, we would go ahead and get there. And so I hope that you'll consider supporting it when it launches. It allows me to do this full time. I want to do this full time. If I don't, you know, ultimately we all have things we have to take care of. And it allows me to bring other people on board. It will improve the quality of the podcast. It will improve our ability to share information and our ability to hopefully begin maybe getting some of the recommendations that are more useful out to people. That's what we want to do. Not trying to do anything beyond the pale, and that's how we got to do it. So hopefully you'll support that and endorse that. And well, I mentioned that because we talked a little bit today about modeling, and it's going to be a much shorter show today. A number of people have said that they want me to try to keep to the hour to an hour and a half range, and I'm going to try. Sometimes the news does not allow it. I can't help where the stories lead and what the information you need is. One trick a lot of people will use is to speed up the podcast a little bit to go through. I recommend doing that. And to the best of my ability, I will try to keep in that window because, believe me, it's not necessarily fun to talk for another hour either. And the reason, for the record, I say Eva is just my mother was from New York, and that's how she said it. Someone asked about that. So it's just one of those things. We have these weird quirks we don't realize, you know, that we do. Okay, so I want to go in. Our final piece here is an estimate from the Australian National University, and it's an estimate about the cost of this virus. And before I put this in front of you, I want to say that the reason I go into analysis, speculation, and details is my goal is not to be a newsreader. I mean, it would be easier to be a newsreader. My goal is to prevent the spread of this virus, keep myself alive, my family alive, and help others stay alive. So I hope you stay alive so we all stay alive. Because if I was just waiting and reacting to news, which some people might enjoy, and they might find it more comforting on some level, I would be doing you a disservice in terms of not providing you the best analysis that I can provide. And that's what differentiates this Flow show. If you want to hear the official company line, you can go listen with all the other people listening to the CNN podcast that will basically be rubber stamped by the government and say nothing they don't want you to hear. Conversely, if you want to go where the action is actually happening to the front line of this, Coronavirus Central is your source. We've been ahead of it from the beginning. We have a long established track record. We've been reporting things before their news, and that's important if you want to keep your family safe. Do we get it wrong sometimes? Occasionally, yes, we do. Do we try to correct ourselves? I do. If something is brought to my attention that I know is wrong, I very much try to put that out there. It does us no good to put information that's incorrect out there. And I think everyone understands that at this point, we are setting up a series of possibilities in the hope of protecting against all of them while we narrow down to what is the largest threat and focus our efforts and energy there. This analysis starts doing that. Coronavirus is highly uncertain and global costs could be high. And like I said, this is from the Australian National University, Tuesday, March 3rd, and this is their projections of what could happen, just to give you a different feel than what I tell you. As coronavirus spreads across the globe, new modeling from the Australian National University, which we'll call ANU from now on, is set to help policymakers respond to the economic costs in the face of a pandemic as the virus evolves. The research paper, which models seven scenarios, is the first wide-ranging global economic assessment of the effects of COVID-19. Four of the seven scenarios in the paper examine the impact of COVID spreading to other countries outside of China, ranging from low to high severity. A seventh scenario examines a global impact where a mild pandemic occurs each year indefinitely. Even in the paper's low-severity scenario, the estimated loss to global GDP is US $2.4 trillion, with more than 15 million deaths globally. The costs rise sharply as the level of severity increases, with the highest potential cost to global GDP rising to US $89 trillion. Now, I just want to take that number here. Or, I'm sorry, it was US $9 trillion. I apologize. They have this in the S look like an H. So never mind what I said. $9 trillion, not $89 trillion. That's their highest cost. And just to put it in context for you, the world GDP estimated right now is estimated at about $85 trillion. The U.S. makes up about $22 trillion of that by most reasonable estimates, of course. So you're talking about, in their worst case scenario, that 10% of the world's productive capacity would have to be used in this, in the worst case scenario. In the best case scenario, you're talking about 3%, okay? And their scenarios, we'll go through them and see what's happening here and see if we agree or disagree when it's all done. But even in the paper, the authors call for coordinated policy response to the virus as well as greater investment in public health in all countries. That absolutely is going to need to happen. The research is by Professor Warwick McKibben and PhD candidate Roshan Fernando, both of the ANU Crawford School of Public Policy and the ANU Center of Excellence in Population Aging Research. It builds on Professor McKibben's modeling of the economic impact of the 2002-2003 SARS and 2006 flu pandemics. The findings provide important information about a range of possible economic costs of the disease in 20 countries and 4 regions, including the OECD and Asia. The paper examines 6 economic sectors, including manufacturing, energy, and mining. In a high-severity scenario, the estimated loss in GDP to Australia in 2020 is $103 billion U.S., with many deaths. Under the same scenario, the global economic outlook is dire. They list a bunch of countries here. China, $1.6 trillion loss. U.S., $1.7 trillion loss. Japan, $549 billion loss. India, $567 billion loss. Our scenarios show that even a contained outbreak could significantly impact the global economy in the short run. In a case where COVID develops into a global pandemic, our results suggest the cost can escalate quickly. Even in the best case scenario of a low severity impact, the economic fallout is going to be enormous, and countries need to work together to limit the potential damage as much as possible. This is particularly the case when it comes to the potential loss of life. The research aims to provide guidance to policymakers for how to best respond to the economic impact Our study shows the possible costs can be avoided through global cooperative investment in public health in all countries. Professor McKibben said there needs to be vastly more investment in public health and development, especially in the poorest countries. All major countries need to participate actively. It's too late to attempt to close the borders once the disease is taking hold in many other countries and a global pandemic has started. Well, we're in 80 countries out of 172. I think we're there. And just how bad these numbers are, you know, we go into them. And just to put numbers on the loss of life on this from this, and I'll go through and do more research on this because I just got this right before the broadcast. I didn't have a chance to read all the details of it. There's an article on Business Insider that has some of this, and there's also a Reddit one that covers it a lot. And I want to just say here before we go into the numbers of it, COVIDReport.net, great website where I got this from, these different links for these particular cases here at the end here, just so that you're aware. But in the low severity model, they estimate a death toll of 15 million based on the Hong Kong flu epidemic. In the high severity model, they are estimating that the death toll will surpass 68 million. I actually believe that that is incredibly low, but it represents what we've talked about on this broadcast before, that there is a rising number that is being contemplated in the public, and that we recognize that the reality of an eight-figure death toll is certainly one that at least the respectable authorities are willing to contemplate. And I would submit to you that that probably needs to increase by at least an order of 10 if we look at it worldwide, just based on, I mean, even just do the simple math, right? If you assume the death rate, let's just assume it's 2%, right? And that, you know, we were talking about 60% of the world getting affected, right? So you have, let's call it 8 billion people, 60% get infected, that's 4.8 billion people times 0.02. You're talking about almost, 0.096, so that would be just a hair short of a billion people. Or did I say that right? No, I said that wrong. 100 million people. Converting this math real fast in my head, right? Anyway, so you're talking about absolutely huge numbers. Nine-figure death tolls are on the table for sure, just with a moderate estimate. And I understand why they're keeping it down. They're hoping, as we all are, that our interventions will work on this. And that's what we're going to focus on. So in the coming days, what you will see this show try to do, and what I'm going to try to do, is not just report, you know, how many cases are in every place. Because I will tell you, as someone who's been tracking this for 5 or 6 weeks, if all I did was come on here and tell you all the horrible things happening in all the places and all the horrible ways it's acting, you would lose hope, you would lose courage, and you would not want to look at this anymore, because I've had those days. What you need is a mindset to fight it. We talk about that, and what I'm going to do is focus on problems we can solve. Whenever we're focused on a single problem we can solve, we don't panic. We're part of the solution. Remember, this is a big problem, but there's also 8 billion people who can be put towards working on it. Make sure you're one of them. That's what we do every day on Coronavirus Central. What I want to say is we'll close with a prayer that, I pray to the Lord that people's eyes be open to the threat before us, and that we learn to get past our previous differences and work together in peace, harmony, and mutual support for one another to create a safer and healthier world for not just those, but those who must follow us, and that we do all we can to prevent suffering in the interim. So this has been Coronavirus Central. Check out everything we do, www.coronaviruscentral.net. We are on YouTube, Facebook. Facebook's site is at Coronavirus Central. Twitter's is at Coronavirus Cast. I'm on there all the time if you need to get information. The Telegram group, join us, share information, t.me/Coronavirus Central. And I will be working in the coming days to get you a better economic understanding of some of this. I'm looking, starting to look at supply chain issues in more detail. And really, the one that scares me the most is food scarcity and getting things from places where people are sick to places, from places where the food supplies are to places where people are healthy. That's probably going to be a choke point. That's why we tell you this is probably your last week to do it before panic. If you haven't done it already, you've seen the videos out there. People are grabbing supplies. You can't get rubbing alcohol at this point. We told you to get that 2 weeks ago. You can't get, hydrogen peroxide. You can't get masks. I'm telling you what to get now. You want to get that 30 to 60 day supply of food. If you can get more, go for it. It's not hoarding, it's planning. Get what you need, work on that. So this has been Coronavirus Central. I'm your host, Tom Kaczynski. We will be back tomorrow. You guys have a very good and blessed day. Goodbye.